Good morning, everybody. I want to begin with an acknowledgement. We acknowledge the triune God, the creator of heaven and earth, and his ownership of all things. We recognize that he gave stewardship of these lands upon which we meet to the Ngunnawal people of Canberra, this meeting place. And his sovereignty has allowed other people to migrate, including me and my family, to these shores. We acknowledge the cultures of our First Nations people and are thankful for the community that we share together now. We pay our respects to the Ngunnawal and to the Kamilaroi and other Indigenous peoples, their elders, leaders, both past and present. In particular, I want to acknowledge the great Bangarang Yorta Yorta leader, William Cooper, a great Christian saint and the father of the Australian Indigenous Justice Movement. I also want to acknowledge that I feel nervous. It's lovely to be welcomed. Are these Waniassans, do I say? By you Waniassans. For one thing, I'm being asked to preach today by a preacher friend of mine who I have long admired. Ian and I did some mission work amongst some schools. It must be 30 years ago now, but much more intimidating, I'm preaching because 81 years ago, a man called William Cooper, that's him, the man that I regard as our greatest Christian leader, my view, certainly the greatest Indigenous justice leader and possibly our greatest Australian. He asked Christians like me to preach sermons on the Sunday before Australia Day. That's today. And I am here to have a go. I'm here to honour that request and I hope that I get to honour him. The greatest Australian? Let me tell you one story about this Yorta Yorta Bangarang elder who saw first contact as a child, then went on to shape our national politics, though he never owned property, he was never elected to political office. Let me tell you about the morning of December 6, 1938. So we're a year before the outbreak of the Second World War. The streets of Footscray were unusually windy and cold for a summer's day, yet outside a cottage on Southampton Street, one of the very few bright moments of that violent century, immaculately dressed in suits and hats, a dozen men and women huddled together, oblivious to the fact that they were making history. All they knew was that they had to march to 419 Collins Street. And quickly, they were scheduled for an 11:30 a.m. with Dr. Dreschler, Consul General, to the Third Reich. The marchers had decided on their message. These few resolved to protest the cruel persecution of the Jewish people by the Nazi government of Germany and asking this persecution be brought to an end. In recent days, stories had filtered through about Kristallnacht, 24 horrifying hours that saw Hitler's brown shirts rampage through the streets of Germany, looting, burning, smashing Jewish stores and synagogues. In just a few hours, 100 Jews had been killed and approximately 30,000 incarcerated in concentration camps. No one knew what was to come, but someone was acting on it already. But remarkably, these protesters weren't Jewish. They were Christians. And yet, Yad Vashem, the world's leading Holocaust research center in Jerusalem, said that their protest was the only one of its kind. It didn't happen in Paris, in France. It didn't happen in London, in the UK. It didn't happen in New York. It happened in Melbourne, in our country, led by people who weren't even citizens of their own country. As far as I can tell, and I've read the letters of William Cooper and all the others, they didn't even know any Jewish people. What possessed William Cooper and his friends of Christian Aboriginals to want to make a stand for Jewish people on the other side of the world. Scratch that about Cooper being a great or greatest Australian. You name another human being that we have known in the last 100 years who made a stand of that kind. Cooper was a great man. He was a big man. And a puzzle. For one thing, this man who never left Australia, and as far as I can tell, never knew one Jewish person, came to identify strongly with the Jews. How did that happen? When he was born in 1860, white fellas had all but taken their land of milk and honey, the fertile country along the Murray River north of Echuca. The new white masters could be as cruel as Egyptian slave drivers. They denied Aboriginal pastoral workers their wages, and stories were told of landed men going on black hunts after the church picnic. Amid this violence around the river, William Cooper found one place where he knew he was safe. It was on an old sacred site called Maloga. His sister had taken him there when he was 14, and he'd met this towering white man with a long beard, looks a lot like Ned Kelly, Daniel Matthews. He learnt to read and write, did William Cooper. It's recorded that he picked up the alphabet to read and write it in 2 days at the age of 14. And then he was taught these stories from a black book about an ancient people who had become slaves and whom God, the creator of the world, would rescue. All it took was a leader brave enough to confront Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." Following a church service in January 1884, Cooper approached Daniel Matthews and said, "I must give my heart to God." He was the last of his brothers and sisters to become a Christian. But from there, he began a lifelong work to speak for the least of these, to confront governments when they were unjust, and to demand to be heard at the highest levels, from the Premier to the Prime Minister to the King, and of course, I should add, to the Führer. Cooper's long campaign for Aboriginal rights, especially land rights, began with the Maloga Petition in 1887. He was one of 11 signatories. It was addressed to the Governor of New South Wales. The petition held that Aborigines of the district should be granted sections of land not less than 100 acres per family, always bearing in mind that Aborigines were the former occupiers of the land. And he added in another piece, remembering that it is ours by divine right. This was 100 years before Mabo. But it was well, who's in their 70s? Anyone in their 70s here? If they can't raise their hand, get someone else to raise their hand. Do you feel like you've maybe done your dash? Like your big contribution is kind of complete now? William Cooper was just getting started at 70. That's when he really hit his straps. He moved to Footscray in Melbourne in 1933, and that's where he found his calling as an activist, an organiser, and a relentless letter writer. If you can still move one hand, you can write. At first, it was in an individual capacity. But by 1935, Cooper had established the Australian Aborigines League. As its secretary, Cooper circulated a petition seeking direct representation in Parliament, enfranchisement and land rights, knowing that, while not technically Australian citizens and limited in their ability to vote, although actually historians have got this wrong on some points, there are a lot of people, Aboriginal people, who could vote at that time, but not automatically. But even if you weren't on the electoral roll, you were still a British subject. And that gives you rights under the rule of law. And so, over several years, he and his team collected 1,814 signatures. Despite active obstruction from the national and state governments, to King George V, cut around the local member of parliament, cut around the cabinet, cut around the prime minister, cut around the governor general, just go straight to the top, like Pharaoh. Here's what he said. Whereas it was not only a moral duty, but also, he's talking to the king here, but also a strict injunction included in the commission issued to those who came to People Australia, that the original occupants and we, their heirs and successors, should be adequately cared for. And whereas the terms of the commission have not been adhered to, in that our lands have been expropriated by Your Majesty's government in the Commonwealth and legal status is denied to us by Your Majesty's government in the Commonwealth, Cooper was effective in securing face-to-face meetings, though he had no constituency, no power. Like Moses, all he had was the truth that he could speak to whoever was in charge. In 1935, he was a part of the first Aboriginal deputation to a Commonwealth minister. I think it was Blackjack McEwen. And then in 1938, the first deputation to the Prime Minister, Joseph Lyons. But there was little result. And so Cooper's Australian Aborigines League joined forces with Jack Patton and William Ferguson, also a fine Christian Aboriginal man. He was a Presbyterian, from the Aborigines Progressive Association to shame white Australia. They arranged a day of mourning to commemorate the sequicentenary of colonisation on Australia Day 1938. The event, which was watched by journalists and police, was held in Australian Hall, which still stands today on Elizabeth Street in Sydney. It was the very first combined interstate protest by Australian Aborigines. You know, you picture in that story Aaron coming in with Moses to confront Pharaoh. You know, these things with the snakes and the staff. This is, these guys had a sense of drama. For you, William Cooper said, this is a day of life, of celebration. For us, it's a day of mourning. Strong biblical symbols. By the time of his death in 1941, aged 80, William Cooper had achieved almost none of the goals that he had set for himself. He saw into the promised land like Moses, but he did not enter it. The land he'd entreated from the New South government was at last given to his people, but that was 40, 50 years after he died. And his relatives held that land today. It's called Cummeragunga. His protege, Pastor Doug Nichols, would drive the next great Indigenous organisation, and they achieved the monumental outcome of the referendum on May 27, 1967. But that was 27 years after he'd passed away. The one success achieved in William Cooper's own lifetime was what you're experiencing today. The establishment of National Aborigines Day, first celebrated in 1940 across the Protestant churches, which he achieved through his partnership with John Needham of St Andrew's Cathedral in Sydney. It was known as Aboriginal Sunday, sometimes Aborigines Day, and it was celebrated on the Sunday nearest to Australia Day. We celebrate it, we all, as a nation, we celebrate it today, but it was moved from January to the end of May, and then today it's known as NAIDOC Week. It's actually named after the committee. Did you know that? It's the National Aborigines, and then later Islanders Day, Organising Committee. How awesome is that committee? They think they're so important. Anyway, that's when we celebrate it. But here's the awful thing. When that moved, us Christians, the Christian community, to whom William Cooper had originally written, the amnesia just set in. So the government remembers the request, and all of our great schools that celebrate NAIDOC Week, they remember, and our churches have forgotten. When you trace, here's the request. This is William Cooper. We request that sermons be preached on this day dealing with the Aboriginal people, wait for it, and their need for the gospel and response to it. And we ask that special prayer be invoked for all missionary and other effort for the uplift of dark people. I became a Christian when I was 16. I don't remember ever praying for Aboriginal people. When you trace the Indigenous justice movement in Australia back to its roots, it always comes back to that one man, William Cooper. It may surprise many progressives that this hero of the Indigenous justice movements drew so heavily on his Christian faith. Equally, it may be a shock to many conservatives that this man who loved the great redeeming God of the book of Exodus thought that it was his Christian duty to demand political reform. But perhaps the greatest scandal is that William Cooper was so open in his challenge to Christians that we should pray that all Indigenous people know the gospel, that we became so deeply aware of the issues they face that we lift up our Aboriginal brothers and sisters to God and to the world. And we've forgotten. We've forgotten William Cooper and the great challenge that he gave us all. Somehow, somewhere, Christians became ashamed of our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. We know that we used to pray for Aboriginal people because I've got the news clippings of what people preached about in the 1940s and the 1950s. I know we used to do this. And then it just petered out. I know it's common to think that we're the first generation somehow to rise up above racism. We wouldn't say what our parents and our grandparents said about Aboriginal people. We don't do that, right? We know the right language to use. But I actually think that Australian Christians had much more interaction. It was wonderful to have an Aboriginal sister with us this morning, but we used to have a lot more interaction with Aboriginal people in our churches in the 30s, the 40s, and before that. And the reason is that every denomination, Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Methodist, the Pentecostals, they all had missions. Some of them had five, from the Gulf of Carpentaria down to the Western Districts of Victoria, New Norcia under the Benedictines. You got your independent missions as well, way up Sunday Island. Everyone was involved. What do we do now? We think it's the government's role, right? With perhaps $5 billion spent a year on various things, so we don't feel like we have to give up anything, let alone our prayers. The people who came out of those missions, when they were church missions, were the ones who confidently came out to make a contribution to the wider culture. And this starts in 1868, when an all-Aboriginal cricket team toured the UK. I tell you, we got to get them back. These guys were amazing. And they, almost all of them, as far as I can tell, came out of missions. They were confident to meet the white world, not just in Australia, in the world. They played at Lord's. The 1868 side, this is a much better set of numbers that we want to hear, right? Was led by an all-star rounder, Johnny Mullagh. The side won 14, lost 14, and drew 19 of their 47 games over 6 months in the UK. How's that? Those Indigenous cricketers had come from the mission communities, including the remarkable Ebenezer Mission, which still stands, by the way, in Western Victoria. And one of those great ones, Dickadick, was a batsman, is buried there today. 20 years later, another all-Aboriginal cricket team, who became known as the Invincibles, that'd be a nice name to have for the Australian cricket team, emerged from a Catholic mission of New Norcia in Western Australia. In football, we saw the same dynamic, Aboriginal people coming out of the mission environment, knowing that they were the equal of any white man. But not only the equal of anyone in the sporting field, but ready to make a contribution as a preacher in politics. A sterling example is Doug Nicholls, who's the nephew of William Cooper and was mentored by William Cooper. He held his own as a labourer outside the devoutly Christian Cummeragunga mission, competed and succeeded as a sprinter. And tell you what, another great sprinter was Lynch Cooper, who was another nephew of William Cooper. He won the Stall Gift. Smart fella, big prize money, and wagered hundreds of pounds on himself at 30-1. I think the Australian Aborigines League was partly funded by gambling. Well, I'm not going to talk about that now. I think that's what happened. But it's Pastor Doug, who's there on the left on a beautiful mural, which you can find today in Shepparton. We're starting to get proud of these guys. Can I tell you, I think the secular world is prouder of them than we are. These are Pastor Doug, on the left, was a preacher. If you read about him in the media at the moment, they've dropped the word Pastor Doug, though he was known that as that universally in the communities, and they use his knighthood, Sir Doug. He became one of Australia's best-known preachers on radio in the 30s and 40s, in the 40s and 50s, using radio to great effect before concluding his career with a knighthood, two of them actually, and an appointment as the governor of South Australia. He is the only Indigenous person to be given a vice-regal position. In our elected parliaments, it's not only the enlightened post-apology era that brought our first Australians to Canberra. It began in the 60s and 70s, and these are people who came out of mission communities, like Senator Neville Bonner, our very first Indigenous parliamentarian. Australian Christians knew about the missions and the amazing people who emerged from them because of Albert Namagiri in the arts. Comes out of Hermannsburg. It's a great Christian mission. It's still going. The amazing people who emerged from these missions because the missionaries came to their churches and Christians read their magazines. They had friendships with the Aboriginal Christians. There was a connection there. But I didn't know anything about this when I was growing up. I started going to church after I became a Christian in the mid-80s, and I remember kneeling at church in sleepy Linfield praying for missionaries in Pakistan and Tanzania, and I had no idea that we had missionaries right here in our own country and we'd been investing in it for 150 years. And I went to university. I was one of the Keenies, Ian. You met me when I was one of the Keenies. At campus Bible study, I remember learning about William Carey and the missions to India, transforming that culture. Widows used to be burnt, on the pyre until William Carey influenced that nation with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Praise God. And I learn about, Hudson Taylor dressing as a Chinaman, planting seeds that came to life 100 years later as the underground church under Mao. And I knew nothing of the missionaries in this country who'd sacrificed the best years of their lives to live in remote communities. I didn't know. I'm part of the great forgetting of the amnesia, which, can I say, we are curing today in your listening. But my ignorance is actually worse than that. It wasn't until 7 years ago with my son Sebastian that I met, in fact, it was your first teacher, mate, at Darrington Public School, who, boom, was Aboriginal, and then, boom, boom, is a Christian. I didn't know there were any Aboriginal Christians. I'm a smart person. I've got an honours degree in philosophy. I didn't know. And it changed with Sebastian's teacher, and then a road trip that we made together in 2011. We were tracing the story of my wife's family, who settled on the Murray, a poor Irishman who failed at growing potatoes. How impossible is that? Is it that hard? But then planted Origins and became a millionaire. And I thought that that was a good story, but then I found a story that's so much better. And then we have our friend, mutual friend, John Dixon, to thank, because I remembered a song that he'd sung called Maranuka, about a missionary called Daniel Matthews. Although at first he was a businessman running a ship chandlery in Echuca. Echuca used to be a really important port for, you know, selling crops down the river. Daniel Matthews is an amazing man, businessman who became a missionary. I think it's to impress a girl. He'd fallen in love with a preacher's daughter, and I've held their love letters in my hands, the State Library of South Australia, and it starts with him saying, you know, I'd really like to get to know you better, and she writes back and says, yeah, fine, but I'm going to become a missionary. I don't know what you're doing. And he writes back and says, I am totally always about becoming a missionary. That's like absolutely the main thing. And she writes, oh, really? I would like to know more. Where is your mission field? And he said, ha, interesting you ask, because I'm talking about, and he actually had wonderful friendships with Aboriginal people. He was a man. Get your picture out of the wheezy missionary out of your head. Think Daniel Matthews, Ned Kelly physique, swimming the Murray in flood, taking a cart across the Murray in flood, just out of sheer willpower and strength. That's a man's man. Going hunting with Aboriginal people, building up friendships, writing to this girl, goes, I'm becoming a missionary to these guys, right, that I go hunting with. Sure enough, he gives up his family estate on the Murray to create this place of safety and of the gospel. It's called Maloga. And one of the first guys who comes in is a 14-year-old called William Cooper. It was down in Echuca on this road trip that everything started to open up. We connected with some local people there. We met one of the guys who was a blood relative of William Cooper, who today is a Christian pastor. His name is Pastor Dennis Atkinson. And for the, yeah, and then we started to meet, I didn't know, do you know, in the census, you can look up the areas that have the lowest, we from Inner City Newtown, we have the low, I think it's 38%, lowest number of people who identify with a Christian tradition. The highest numbers are where? Yeah, they're in the Aboriginal communities. They haven't forgotten. They've remembered the gospel. We've forgotten them. After I met these guys and I started learning their stories, I'm an ad man, I'm not a clergyman, I'm not, you know, I don't have a master's degree in history, but I just knew I just had to keep passing on these stories to honour William Cooper. Once you realise you've been part of the silence, it's easy to feel defensive. I wonder if you felt defensive when you came in and heard it was going to be about Aboriginal people. I do instinctively. You minimise what's happened. It just feels so uncomfortable. Then in your better moments, you think, well, what can I do anyway? My answer is to do for yourself, if you're thinking about this right now in your seat, do what Christians have always done. Build a friendship. Make a friendship with an Indigenous person wherever you can. Often it'll be through sport. Sometimes it'll be through the church. We still think, you know, the Australian Aboriginal Evangelical Fellowship gets no support, as far as I can tell, from any white church. These are the descendants and friends of William Cooper. I'll tell you what happened to us and to Sebastian and me and our family. It was on a car trip back from Echuca after a year or two of my friendship with Uncle Boydie, who's William Cooper's last remaining grandson. And he asked me a question. A year before, we'd been involved in a reenactment of that march for Kristallnacht to the German embassy. And the wonderful thing is, 80 years after William Cooper had been brushed off by Dreschler, the current German consul to Australia welcomed Uncle Boydie, welcomed the letter, sent the message back to Berlin, and history started to get restored. And here's Uncle Boydie in the front of my Ford, and he says, "Matt," he's 90 years old now, "there's something else we have to do." He said, "I need your help getting that petition, the one that was for George V. We need to get it to Her Majesty the Queen. Can you help me?" And I said, "I am calling her right now." I had no idea. I just started doing what William Cooper did, right? Starts with a letter, a really nice letter to your local member, to the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, to the Prime Minister. At that time, it was Tony Abbott, who was surprisingly receptive, to Clarence House, to St. James Palace. And I don't know how it happened exactly, but I tell you the truth. It was on Good Friday, it was good in so many ways. 2014, in that same car, Uncle Boydie in the same seat, we are driving past 100 heavily armed federal police through the gates of Admiralty House into a meeting room with Prince William, whose great-great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather had never received the petition from William Cooper. He said, "I'm going to get it straight to my grandmother." And he did. And that unfinished business was getting finished. Can I tell you a secret? Do I have time to tell the secret? This is our secret. To get that meeting going, one person that we reached out to was a former Governor General. You can work out who it is. I said I wouldn't tell anybody his name. One of the good ones, you know? We've had some patchy ones. He was a good one. And Uncle explained what he wanted to do to get the petition to Her Majesty because, you know, that's what William Cooper wanted. And the former Governor General, big boardroom, amazing view of Lake Burley Griffin on the north side, listened carefully and then said, "Why on earth would you waste your time? They're morons." He'd been paid to represent that family. They're morons. They don't do anything. They're pointless. They're irrelevant to Australia. What you want to do is put political pressure on, get some funding, table an act. And William Cooper's grandson, Uncle Boydie, listened so very carefully and then said, "But my grandfather wrote this to go to the king." So at that moment, I knew Aboriginal people, and I have so much to learn, have a completely different understanding of history. It doesn't matter what pressure group gets formed and disappears this week. It's about completing great things. You know, in 1788, King George gave a direct instruction to our leaders to conciliate the affections of the native people. That was the law. It's still the law. The interesting thing about William Cooper and the interesting thing about Moses is it's not violent, it's not revolutionary, it's calling your leader, your king, your prime minister to do the right thing simply because it is the right thing. There's so much more unfinished business. Every time the Closing the Gap speech will be the first speech of the Parliament, first week of Parliament. There is so much left. Can I tell you, when you see those literacy results that'll come out, they were better in the mission period. When Christians like us were doing our job and sharing the gospel in Maloga, in New Norcia, up there in East Arnhem Land, William Cooper wrote a really good letter. He was taught to read and write by missionaries. When you hear those Closing the Gaps statements, there are so many gaps to fill. I don't know how they get filled, but I tell you this, the only way they've got filled in the past is through prayer and fellowship and friendship and preaching the gospel. That's why William Cooper asked us believers to keep praying for missionaries. So you're taking a great step. Thank you for inviting me to come down and to preach, because you've allowed me to fulfill my moral obligation to William Cooper. And you guys have participated in that today as well. The rest of the church has forgotten. You're coming out of your amnesia in hearing me speak now. Thank you for having me. It's over to you now to keep Aboriginal people, their need for Christ, their need for justice, which William Cooper himself asked for in your prayers. And we're going to pray. And I'm looking forward to that. Thank you for inviting me to speak.